Hi, this is John Harcher, and welcome to episode 34 of Keep On Grooving. Today, we start our look at Jimi Hendrix's unmoving image, detailing his appearances on the large and small screen and their current availability. We'll also do our best to point out the best versions of all the appearances, and if it's worth it to hunt down earlier editions. Now, before we do that, the Layla recording date updates part 2. I dug out the 20th anniversary box set, plus some of the guys on the Hoffman boards chimed in. And regarding Thorn Tree in the Garden of Mean Old World, it's exactly the opposite of what I thought. Thorn Tree was done on September 10th at the end of the original sessions. Mean Old World was done on October 2nd during the overdub sessions. Eric and Dwayne mainly use Fender Champ amplifiers, but may have used a Pignose prototype on some tracks. The official one wasn't available, I think, until like 71 or so. Also saw a nice story on YouTube on Bobby Whitlock's channel. When the 40th anniversary set was announced, Eric asked what kind of residuals Bobby would be getting for it. He was told none, since Bobby had sold his catalog many years ago. Clapton not only bought the rights back for him, but he also had the publishing corrected for Bell Bottom Blues, adding Whitlock's name to the credits. Shows what kind of guy he is. For my Layla playlist, I add in the Roll It Over B-side in between I Am Yours and Any Day. On my 90-minute tape back in the day, I had the Tell the Truth single start off side 2 right for the album version, but not for the playlist. A little bit too much there. I also completely rework side 4. I have it as It's Too Late, Thorn Tree, Mean Old World, Little Wayne, and Layla. But I have to say, I do like the 40th anniversary 5.1 mix that has Mean Old World at the end as well. Okay, done with Clapton for now. Episode 34, Jimi Hendrix at the Movies and on TV, 1965 to 1973. Since we've exhausted all the officially available audio releases and are patiently awaiting the next one, maybe a big one, it's time to look at the video side of things. There aren't as many out there as albums, but there's quite a bit, and for some, there's several different ways to watch them. So we'll start today dealing with four groups of three appearances: UK and European television, US television, movies that came out while he was alive, and three that came out in the few years after he died. That should be more than enough for one episode. We'll talk just about how they came out at the time and hold off on director's cuts and alternate edits until later. As we mentioned way back in the second episode, Jimmy in the studio was one thing, but Jimmy live was something else. In the same way, hearing him live is one thing, but hearing and seeing him live, well, that's the whole package. He started to learn showmanship back in his days on the Chitlin' Circuit. We can see evidence of this in the very lucky it's still around clip from the Nashville show Night Train, with a local act, Buddy and Stacy, doing the Junior Walker song Shotgun. Jimmy was part of Little Richard's band at the time, so that's who's playing behind these two guys. We see him right in the back doing all the moves with the band and everything. So it's a great place to start Jimmy viewing. Once he got to England and started his career with the Experience, doing the rounds on TV and radio shows was a big part of promotion. Unfortunately, for historical purposes, there's not a whole lot left from that era. The BBC and other services weren't thinking in terms of posterity, so they tended to reuse the tapes they already had, or for TV broadcasts, they didn't do it on the tape, they just sent it out live. For radio, we have the 5 BBC shows from 1967. There may be a few others out there, but they're more obscure. For television, it's even more scattershot. You have a video from a French show in the summer of 1967 for Wild Thing. You can find a wide variety of appearances for Burning the Midnight Lamp, both audio and video. I thought I saw a video at one point for the one where they started playing Alan Price's house that Jack built, but I haven't found it again. Bit ironic considering how it was a disappointment chart-wise that we had so many versions of that song out there. But we'll go over three performances in particular, one from 1967, one from 1968, and one from 1969. What makes the one from 1967 significant is not its length or what was performed, but where it ended up being seen years later. On March 2nd, the Jimi Hendrix Experience recorded an appearance at the Marquee Club in London for the German show Beat Club. Jimmy was dressed in a pre-Sergeant Pepper military-type jacket. I think it's the same one he wore in the San Francisco Street Show and on the cover of Radio 1, as well as in a film we'll see later. They start with their hit single, Hey Joe, complete with guitar solo played with the Teeth. They follow with Purple Haze, introduced as their new single out in a few weeks, and is performed with a lot of gusto and feedback towards the end. Noel kind of gets lost in the sound shuffle between Jimmy's guitar and Mitch's constant circular drumming, but overall, a decent performance. So what makes this really significant? In the mid-80s, MTV began to cement itself as a prime cultural force in the presentation of music to a younger audience. All artists were now expected, if they released a single, they needed to make a video. Some bands caught on by the strength of their videos alone, Duran Duran being a prime example. Not dissing the music, in fact, their stuff holds up pretty well today. By the late 80s, the station was looking to show other things and present older material to a new audience, so the concept of classic MTV was born. Problem was, there weren't a lot of videos in the old days, and as I mentioned, a lot of things just got lost. An exception was Beat Club. For some reason, they kept a lot of their older material, so they ended up being a main source of videos for them. They had Hendrix, they had The Who, they had Black Sabbath, they had King Crimson. You know, so these videos were an introduction to a number of these older artists. Beat Club has another appearance on their YouTube channel, this time for a May 18th appearance on the show Beat, Beat, Beat. They did three songs there, Stone Free, Hey Joe, and Purple Haze. Stone Free has an audio drop towards the end, but it's well worth watching to get an idea what the song may have sounded like if they did it at, like, Monterey. One other thing from 1967, you heard me mention the show Hepla from the Netherlands a few times during the other shows. It's where Catfish Blues from the Blues albums come from, as well as a version of Foxy Lady that was a B-side of Loverman from Both Sides of the Sky. Now, for all these years, I've been under the impression it was just one of the many radio broadcasts across Europe. Well, it turns out it was one of the many TV broadcasts across Europe. There doesn't appear to be any footage of it anywhere, but good to get this right, finally. The second noteworthy appearance is from 1968, and we don't actually have video of it, but luckily audio is still available. The Experience spent January doing concerts on the continent, culminating in the two shows at the Paris Olympia. Then they flew back to the States to record Electric Ladyland and tour there. They didn't return to Europe until after the Miami Pop Festival in late May. The two-week swing started in Italy, went up to Switzerland, then ended with an appearance on Dusty Springfield's show, It Must Be Dusty, on June 5th. The band did three songs on the show. They kick off with Stone Free, which hadn't been a regular part of the live shows much at that point. Then Dusty comes on and does a duet with Jimmy on her earlier hit, Mockingbird. Jimmy may have done it during his days on the Chitlin circuit, but it doesn't look like he'd done it where it was recorded. The appearance ended with what looks like the premiere of Voodoo Child to the public. It's shortened but very close to the sound of the Electric Ladyland version. For quite a while, it was thought the show was completely lost, but then audio clips of it began to turn up. There's a version of all three songs on YouTube in pretty good quality. There's also stray footage of the show taped off of some kind of broadcast. Somebody went and semi-synced up parts of it to Mockingbird, so that's probably the best we'll ever get of this. The final appearance is from 1969, and it's the one everybody probably thinks of when they mention TV appearances. On January 4th, the band were guests on Lulu's show, A Happening for Lulu. Hey, boy, who didn't have a show back then? The band had actually taken almost all the previous December off, so they'd spend the months much as they did the year before, touring the continent before culminating at the concerts at Royal Albert Hall. So they started where they'd end, in London at the BBC. We've talked about it before, the band kicked off a Voodoo Child, already becoming a concert favorite. Then Lulu introduces Hey Joe, and they kick into the crazy intro similar to how they did at Winterland. Then as Lulu was supposed to come on to do the next verse with Jimmy, he ends the song and kicks into Sunshine of Your Love. There's a bit of a question if they ended up missing something due to the change of plans, but it looks like they just ran the segment down to the very last second and went to commercial from there. This is one of those moments that solidified their images as rebels. That basically takes care of their major appearances on television outside the US. They were broken up a few months later, and Jimmy looked to put together a new band. In July, he ended up on not one, but two network shows, and in the same week. On Monday, July 7th, he made his first appearance on The Dick Cavett Show. He was an unlikely choice for a talk show host, a little guy with an urbane sense of humor, but he made it work by getting people together from the well-known to outside the mainstream. Now, he ended up bouncing all over the networks and all over the schedule. He started out in the morning, moved to Prime, moved to late nights, moved networks, moved to PBS. Yeah, it's crazy. On this night, Cavett was on ABC and in Prime. His guests, apart from Jimmy, were dancer Gwen Verdon, Hollywood writer Garson Kanin, and Robert Downey Sr. Yes, he was well known back then. I'm not sure if he was still promoting Putney Swope, but so as you can see, an eclectic group, to put it mildly. Jimmy came on last. He's introduced with the clip from Monterey Pop, where he's burning the guitar. Then the house band plays Foxy Lady as he comes out. He's dressed in this loose blue shirt and talked for a good 5 or 6 minutes. Cavett asks him to explain why do all the destruction. Jimmy says, it's kind of a release, and he goes into the meaning of music. We even get a definition of the electric church concept. Cavett brings up the point that people don't understand how someone who's rich can go and sing the blues. Jimmy says sometimes that's when it's the easiest. When asked if he's disciplined enough to get up and practice every day, he replies, he just tries to get up every day. After they were done, Jimmy plugged in and played a short version of Hear My Train a Comin' with the Cavett Studio Band. Interesting to hear it done with a very different bass line. Song's over and done in 2 minutes and 25 seconds. On Thursday, July 10th, Jimmy appeared on The Tonight Show. No, it wasn't from LA back then, and no, Johnny wasn't in. Flip Wilson was a guest host. His stint probably helped him get his show on the network the following year. Now, that would have been fun seeing Jimmy and Geraldine on the same stage. But here, it was just the two of them in a brief conversation. They talk a little bit about the spirituality of music, then when they're done, Jimmy introduces Billy Cox on bass in his debut appearance with him in public, and Tonight Show drummer Ed Shaughnessy was behind the kit. They break into Loverman, then right as the solo starts, Jimmy's amp blows up and they have to bring in a new one. Ah, the joys of live TV. Once the amp is back in place, they do a quick version of Loverman to make sure it fits into the segment. It actually sounds really cool. Doesn't look like the video for this is still around, but luckily there is audio of it. Jimmy returned to the Dick Cavett Show on September 9th. He was supposed to do the show the day after Woodstock with Joni Mitchell, Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Jefferson Airplane, but since he didn't finish until 9 in the morning or so, he really wasn't up for it. His fellow guests were Robert Young, who just started a little show named Marcus Welby MD a few months earlier, and Ralph Nader, probably complaining about some product. Again, an eclectic group to be sure. This time Jimmy came on second. The appearance started with the band of Billy, Mitch, and Juma playing Isabella in its second live outing. Jimmy has a Gibson SG instead of his usual Stratocaster. As a bonus, they end with a good part of Machine Gun, a song they'd started putting together and debuted a few days earlier at a Harlem Street Festival. Jimmy basically had the same shirt on but different color pants. This time he talked about his days in the Army, which was contrasted with his playing of the Star Spangled Banner at Woodstock. Now, you have to remember in those days, there wasn't any instant gratification. The general public outside of the 25,000 people in Bethel that morning hadn't heard it and wouldn't until 6 months later when the movie premiered, then on the soundtrack a few weeks after that. They talked about it quite a bit, but it's a little hard to put it in context without having heard it. Later on, then they could put it in context after everybody knew it, like the back of their hand. He also talked about why so many bands are breaking up and going on and doing other things. A favorite moment is when Cavett described him as one of the greatest guitar players in the world. He visibly shrunk down in humbleness. Cavett quickly added the greatest guitar player in the studio, to which Jimmy added, in this chair. It showed he wasn't a big show-off or anything like that, but a very down-to-earth and quiet-spoken man. Okay, maybe not totally down-to-earth. There were some spacey moments, to be sure. It's interesting that for these three performances, Jimmy decided to do songs the public couldn't get on album. He did the two oldies, for lack of a better term, that he'd been doing for years on the July appearances, and a new song, or two, for the September appearance. It's also interesting to see Jimmy interact on some level with people you would never put in the same category with him, like the one in the second Cavett show with Jimmy and Robert Young in the same shot. I mean, what would happen if Princess brought him to the Anderson household one day? Now, there is one major TV appearance that no one saw because it never aired. In May 1968, a crew from ABC followed the experience around and filmed them in the studio and at live appearances. Most famously, they were in the studio during the recording of Voodoo Child's Slight Return. They also recorded some footage of the concert at the Fillmore a week later and in Miami a week after that. Unfortunately, to this day, it doesn't look like it was ever broadcast, or even worse, the footage has disappeared. No one even has a clue where it is now. One other thing, he was also promoted to be making an appearance on the Ed Sullivan Show in November 1968, but it never happened. Probably around the time he played with the Philharmonic. We'll get to that one at some point. I mean, can you imagine Jimmy on the Ed Sullivan Show? If Ed had trouble with Elvis, Mick Jagger, and Jim Morrison. Ugh. So that takes care of Jimmy's major TV appearances. Now it's on to the cinema. In late 1967, Jimmy had a concert at Blackpool, England, filmed for possible use. After that, filmmaker Peter Neal followed the band around, getting all kinds of candid moments. And of course, on December 19th, he was in the studio with Jimmy, found an acoustic 12-string guitar, and had him do a number that became known as Hear My Train a Comin'. All this footage would be used for the film entitled Experience that was released on August 19th, 1968. The film later became known as See My Music Talking. It wasn't a full-length film, but a half-hour short subject. It was narrated by someone who had some quote-unquote experience with Jimmy, namely Alexis Korner, who Jimmy appeared on his BBC show. The film would be bookended by two songs performed at Blackpool, Purple Haze at the opening of the film and Wild Thing at the end, marking the first time audiences other than concert goers or viewers of that Beat Club episode saw him do the song, and it wouldn't be the last. In between, we get a number of montages set to Jimmy's music. The one they do for Foxy Lady could have been a full-blown video, but it's a slightly shortened version. There's a fun little bit with the Indian verse of Castles Made of Sand. May This Be Love gets a skydiving sequence. There's bits of Mitch and Noel interviewing Jimmy in some randomly edited shots. It also previewed a couple of tracks from Electric Ladyland as background music. It even ends with If Six Was Nine a year before it was in another film we'll talk about eventually. And of course, most importantly, it has the segment with Jimmy in the black hat and the white room on a stool playing the acoustic guitar for the song Get My Heart Back Together, which would become Hear My Train a Comin'. This was a real spur-of-the-moment decision. There was a 12-string guitar lying around. They restrung it, gave it to Jimmy to see what would happen. Something special sure did. The funny thing is, at the beginning of the segment, Jimmy is playing around with some chords, and he tells the cameraman to not waste the film like that. Sure enough, before the song is over, the camera runs out of film. That's what it was like back then with those 8 to 10 minute reels. That's why the footage cuts away in this picture and a later one where it's prominently featured before the song is over. Now, about 20 years ago or so, AMC, back before it had commercials and Breaking Bad and Walking Dead, they had a weekend where they ran all kind of music films. One of them was Experience. I believe it was before the DVD came out. That came out, I think, 2002. We'll talk about those later. I may have it on a VHS tape somewhere, but I haven't found it. They played the film, and then at the end, they did a full video of Voodoo Child's Slight Return. It wasn't of the band, but just a bunch of clouds floating around for 5 minutes. When the DVD came out, it wasn't there. I saw the film on some other platforms, and it wasn't there either. It's nowhere online, so I'm wondering if I just imagined it. Jimmy's first major splash on the American music scene was at the Monterey Pop Festival, so it's somewhat appropriate that his first major big screen appearance was in the film about it. Filmmaker D.A. Pennebaker spent 3 days filming not only the bands on stage, but the audiences gathered in the San Francisco area that weekend. It would be an attempt to show the mainstream public that these folks really weren't crazy. Or maybe they were. Papa John Phillips was the main guy in charge, so we see him not only on stage, but also in a lot of behind-the-scenes moments as well. It also explains why the Mamas and the Papas kick off the film with California Dreaming when they were actually one of the last acts on Sunday. The decision was made to keep the film under an hour and a half. In fact, well under it, runs just under 80 minutes. So they weren't going to be able to present all the artists that were there over the 3 days. So we get one song, sometimes two, from the act Pennebaker thought would represent the diversity of the people there. Which is why it's a little annoying that we don't get the first live song until 9.5 minutes in. Well, that's not 100% correct. Big Brother's combination of the two plays under the opening credits. So after the Mamas and the Papas, we get Canned Heat doing the blues, then right into Simon and Garfunkel and Feeling Groovy. Which is odd because the first one was Saturday afternoon, while the boys actually played Friday night. Next is Hugh Masekela doing the Healing song, actually singing, not on his horn as usual, at least at the start, and then he picks it up towards the end. We then get another of the local acts, Jefferson Airplane, doing High Flying Bird and Today. Not the two you'd expect from them. Then it's one of the festival's big moments, Big Brother's version of Ball and Chain, where a lady named Janis Joplin just took the song and made it her own. Wow, can a lady rock? She certainly did. There's this really cool shot of Mama Cass and the audience just watching her stunned. Yeah. Eric Burdon and the Animals are next, doing not one of their own songs, but one from a band who wasn't there. Their unique arrangement of the Rolling Stones' Paint It Black. Then another festival highlight, The Who's My Generation and the Absolute Destruction of the Stage. Pete had a hard time breaking that Stratocaster, didn't he? Now, this actually happened closer to someone else's set, but they figured to space it out a bit to give a little breathing room. Throwing Sleeping Hippies and Country Joe and the Fish next certainly accomplishes this. Then we get another of the festival's big moments, a set from Otis Redding and Booker T and the MGs. They include about half of Shake and all of I've Been Loving You Too Long. Then the moment we've been waiting for. They pick up Jimmy just as he starts the feedback intro and tells everyone to cover their ears. The camera stays focused on him the whole time, then he breaks into Wild Thing. We get a cut to see Noel during the verses where he chimes in and then back and forth a bit until the solo. Then during the last chorus where Jimmy swings the guitar behind his back, we get a wide shot of the band before we go back to the close-up. Mitch finally gets a close-up right before Jimmy hums the amps. Then back to Mitch for a second, and then out comes the lighter fluid and the matches. And of course, right at this point, there's annoying hair at the bottom of the screen. It's old cameras. We know what happens after that. Things burn, things get smashed. And then they show the audience. One of the girls looks utterly shell-shocked. Another has her hand clasped in her face like, oh my God. Another is enjoying it more, slamming her tambourine in the air. A full 7.5 minutes, I believe the longest single performance of anyone in the film. You don't cut away from that. The Mamas and the Papas come back with Got a Feeling. The film ends with lots of B-roll footage over a Ravi Shankar performance and lots of the other performers watching, including Jimmy. Now, did I say Jimmy had the longest performance in the film? Well, scratch that. This is the longest one in the film. We don't even see Ravi until 7 minutes in. I guess he's like Buddy Miles in some way. If you're not into it, a little goes a long way. In this case, 17 minutes worth. The Beatles weren't there, but were involved in the selection of acts. Jimmy was Paul's idea. Not surprisingly, Ravi was George's. With that, the film ends. Interestingly, one of the cameramen was Albert Maysles, who did his own documentary where Jimmy was sort of involved. We'll touch on that one in a bit. Another one was Peter Philippian. We'll hear more from him later as well. Bob Newworth, who wrote Janis Joplin's Mercedes-Benz, did some camera work as well. The film was supposed to be aired as a special on ABC. However, once the execs saw the footage, especially of Jimmy and his amplifier lovemaking, the filmmakers were shown the door. So they ended up releasing it to theaters. It showed up the day after Christmas, 1968. Maybe I should add this on to the Christmas special next year. It wasn't a huge hit at the box office, but was definitely successful in terms of its impact. It captured images of four of the big artists who made their splash that day. Unfortunately, Otis was gone over a year at this point. And it also inspired a group of guys to try something of their own, this time on the other coast. Yes, it helped inspire Woodstock. We know the stories. They settled on doing it on a farm owned by Max Yasger. The crowd being so large, they closed down the New York Thruway, which is actually quite a ways away from there, by the way. And then they let everybody in without a ticket because there were so many people. Someone in their wisdom figured if they could do Monterey, we could film our show as well. So Michael Wadley was given the task of filming as much as he could and making a movie out of it. Luckily, the sound was being taken care of by someone who knew what he was doing, Eddie Kramer. The stories coming out of the festival were legion, so there was a lot of anticipation for the film about it. Wadley helped edit the film himself, along with an acquaintance from NYU, Thelma Schoonmaker. She, in turn, brought on board an NYU student filmmaker she'd been working with, Martin Scorsese. The film was released on March 26, 1970. Instead of trying to summarize the show into a 90-minute film, they decided to capture the enormousness of it by bringing it in at over 3 hours. In between the performances, we got to know people like Max Yasgur himself, announcer Wavy Gravy, and the guy who cleaned the porta-potties. Everybody's got to have a job. The performances started with Richie Havens and his medley, including Freedom and Motherless Child. Joan Baez was next with Joe Hill and Swing Low Sweet Chariot. Then The Who did the very end section of We're Not Gonna Take It, See Me, Feel Me, Listening to You, and then Summertime Blues, a few months before Live at Leeds came out. Then came the out of nowhere Sha Na Na doing At the Hop, which was actually right before the final act, and we know who that was. Joe Cocker made his flailing debut doing the Beatles with a little help from my friends. Then, if you haven't heard, it rained a little bit during the concert. So much so that the crowd started to do a no rain chant to make it stop. Country Joe and the Fish did rock and soul music, followed by Arlo Guthrie, Shadow Traffic, and Coming into Los Angeles. The trio of David Crosby, Stephen Stills, and Graham Nash made their second appearance in front of people doing Sweet Judy Blue Eyes. The other partner of their quartet pouted and didn't want to be on film. That's Neil. Then came one of the film's big surprises. Few people had heard of Alvin Lee or 10 years after before the movie, but they sure remember his lightning-fast jam and the 10-minute I'm Going Home. Things mellowed down for Jefferson Airplane Saturday afternoon, performed oddly enough on Sunday morning. Love and Spoonful's John Sebastian did Younger Generation Blues, then disappeared for 6 years before he was welcome back. Country Joe McDonald gets a second segment, this time on his own, doing one of the funnest protest songs you'll ever hear, The Fixin' I'm Gonna Die Rag. And it's 1, 2, 3, what are we fighting for? Michael, Marty, and Thelma saved a great 1, 2, 3 punch combo for the film's final half hour. First, for those who didn't like drum solos, Michael Shreve saw how cool they could be in Soul Sacrifice by Santana. Just think, they wouldn't get a number one song for 30 years, then got two back-to-back. Then came Saturday Night's closer of sorts, Sly and the Family Stone, doing Dance to the Music into I Want to Take You Higher. It's a stunning image as Sly is there in the dark doing a call and response with the audience. He calls out, Wanna take you higher. Then 500,000 unseen people answer back, higher, practically shaking the screen. Then it's the moment we've all been waiting for. After the bit from Max Yasgur, we see Jerry Velez resting on his congas as we hear the end of Voodoo Child. The camera slowly pans over and we see Jimmy from the back finishing the song, then topping it off with his teeth. Then as he begins a Star-Spangled Banner, the camera's crossfade to see Jimmy from the front focusing in on his face. The camera pulls back, but we still don't see the guitar. It zooms back in as he begins the dime bombs, and halfway through, they focus in on the guitar and stay with it through the second set of dime bombs. They go back up to Jimmy's face for most of the rest, then back to the guitar for the last verse and the end of the song. Jimmy moves into Purple Haze, and the funniest part is when he ducks down doing his usual move at the beginning of the song, he goes completely out of frame. We get the first two verses with Jimmy on screen, then for the solo, the footage changes to what was left after the show was over. Then we hear something the album called Instrumental Solo, but we later came to know it as Villanova Junction. As the Muddy Hippies pick up garbage, the song ends and so does the film. The performance has entered rock legend, but if you ask me, it's not only from the actual performance, but Wadley's camera shots and editing choices that also helped lead to its mythical status. That takes care of Jimmy's appearances on the big screen during his lifetime. However, as we've discussed, Mike Jeffrey came up with two big screen projects of his own. First, he hired Monterey Pop cameraman Peter Polyphian to film Hendrix's two concerts at Berkeley on May 30th. The intention was to emulate Woodstock, in a sense, and put out a film and an album based around the concerts. And, of course, things did not go as planned. The shows were recorded, as well as a lot of B-roll footage. Almost a year after Jimmy's death, Jimmy Plays Berkeley premiered on September 13, 1971. It wasn't an epic like Woodstock, or even a short feature like Monterey Pop. It ran a very tight 50 minutes or so, enough for three complete songs out of the over 20 performed between the two shows and almost 30 if you add in the rehearsals. The film opens with footage of the band's equipment with an early version of Straight Ahead playing in the background. Jimmy's in the limo heading to the show with Devin in the back seat with him. He goes inside and we see the rehearsals with a little piece of Blue Suede Shoes playing behind it. Jimmy, Billy, and Mitch are getting themselves all set up. We hear a little Earth Blues when Jimmy cuts it short. We move to outside, a bunch of picketers complaining about having to pay to see the Woodstock film. One guy is upset Hendrix didn't do anything for the people. Another girl is mad she has to pay $3.50 for a film the people made. I'm sure Michael Wadley was surprised that there were that many people in the editing booth with him. Then we get to my favorite guy, the dude with the pickup truck, who would have run their legs over if they didn't move. He's actually sympathetic with them to a point, but they're blocking the sidewalk because they don't want to see a movie. The world isn't going to change over that. As the camera focuses in on a little American flag, Jimmy is rehearsing the Star Spangled Banner. Rehearsals end with Easy Rider and Jimmy's foot action on the wah-wah and the boys going over Hey Baby. The performances begin in earnest with the first set and the incendiary cover of Chuck Berry's Johnny B. Goode, presented in almost its entirety. We don't get it from the start. It fades in just before he starts singing, so we don't miss any of the good stuff. This is the first of several of these kind of issues. We get clips of Hear My Train A-Comin', soon to be featured on an album, just not the one people expected. Coverage of the first set ends with the twofer of the Star Spangled Banner and Purple Haze with the edit arpeggios and teeth playing ending back to back. I think this Purple Haze is one of the best versions of it, even though he messes up the lyrics of the second verse. This section ends with the arrest of a kid who broke the glass on the doors, presumably to get in for the show. But the guard seems to be in a good mood about it. For the second set, we get a section of I Don't Live Today, a very brief snippet of Straight Ahead, I think like 3 or 4 seconds, a decent portion of Hey Baby, and an abbreviated Lover Man, which, by the way, was not in their performance order, before we get the obligatory 60s protest montage set to Machine Gun. But it was what Berkeley was known for, so it's not completely unexpected. We get more than half of the song, so it's a positive. We don't get the Yonder Stands a Mother verse, though it's explicitly edited out. I don't know why. The film ends with a full 10-minute set-closing Voodoo Child site return, complete with the Midnight Lightning lyrics tossed in. He does some cool things like playing the guitar under his leg and more teeth playing for Haley and Alex Dunphy down there in the front, but it's not quite as wild as his Monterey days. He's focusing a lot on playing, and the performances benefit from this. Around this time when he was doing Voodoo Child, Jimmy was repeating the, if I don't see you no more in this world, section like 3 or 4 times, like emphasizing it, so Pete definitely had to include that in the film. The film was underwhelming, not by the performances, but by how little of them there were. I think the most interesting thing about Jimmy's look in the film is he's as close to clean-shaven as he'd been since his Curtis Knight days. As we talked about in the earlier episode about Berkeley, his outfit in the first set is a black shirt, blue headband, multicolored vest, and scarves tied around his sleeve. Just cool looking. The second set has him in this powder blue caftan type thing that Maud Finley would have died for. The film itself is longer than experienced, but not by much. Like I said, it's like 48, 50 minutes. Not sure why they thought this piecemeal approach would be preferable to including entire songs unless there weren't that many full songs filmed. It was thought for years there wasn't any more footage around, but it turned out not to be the case. As we mentioned, the plan was to have a film and album out at the same time. The film came out. The album entirely dedicated to the shows wasn't, but 3 tracks heard in the film made it out on In the West. So that was one project downtime for the next one. right around the time Jimmy Plays Berkeley went in and out of theaters, the other Mike Jeffrey project had its premiere. We've talked a lot about Wave that ended up becoming Rainbow Bridge. We did a whole episode on it, the situation around it, and the actual concerts. Today, we're going to talk about the movie itself, at least one version of it. When the film debuted, the distributor felt it needed some changes, like losing a five-minute black screen in front of the film when Chuck Wein wanted to have different smells to be released in the theater or something like that. Makes Bob Weir's request to record Heavy Air during the Anthem of the Sun session seem downright reasonable. So they took it down from over 2 hours to around an hour 45 minutes, so they didn't cut all that much of it at first. When this didn't seem to stimulate audiences, they hacked another half hour out of it, left most of the Jimmy footage in, but not all, and dumped the 75-minute version into drive-in theaters as the B half of the ticket. That's what we'll be going over today. The film opens with some swirling images doing ohm in the background, a shot of people on horses that suddenly goes to negative with singing in the background, like, okay. Then some guy shoots a surfer to the sound of a live version of Easy Rider, then his spirit floats away. Okay. Enough of that, onto the opening credits and a sped-up version of Earth Blues. Great idea to have an odd font color so we can't really read the credits on the ever-changing background. Pat Hartley gets an introducing credit, and the band is billed as the Jimi Hendrix Experience with Billy and Mitch's names added underneath. Well, wait a minute. What's that? A pair of eyes. They're like staring at me. Stop looking at me. Stop looking at my soul! No! God, if you were on acid, you'd be running out of the theater already. Jeez. Hey, Mike Jeffrey gets his name in a different font so you can actually see it. Not so for producer Barry D. Prendergast, and he could barely see Chuck Wein's name. We meet up with our heroine, Pat Hartley, as she's walking somewhere, and hippies are just bugging the living daylights out of her in close-up. Are we supposed to like these people or want her to go all Charles Bronson on them? Suddenly it's nighttime and people are still bugging her as she walks down the street. Then she apparently jaywalks. We don't actually see her crossing the street. We see a don't walk sign and a horn. With all the crime going on, this is what attracts the cops, who arrest her after she names her grandmother or makes a joke out of it. So far, not exactly seeing what she did wrong. I think they're probably a bit overzealous here. She leaves the jail in the morning, and now we see her crossing the street to get on the bus. Then we find out what she's been carrying around in her bag, a big tape player, like a boombox in 71. Wow, that was out of place. But it's just what we need for some incidental music to play over our montage, Dolly Dagger. Jeffrey pulled it off of Cry of Love for this. Thanks, Mike. We see a nuclear explosion. Then she gets off the bus by some oil drilling rigs so she can watch some dudes go surfing. Then she's back on the bus. Was that like a planned stop? Of course, then the bus breaks down, so Pat hitches a ride to San Diego Airport. Wait, I think she was walking through Los Angeles. Doesn't Los Angeles have an airport? Seem to remember hearing about one once. Some guys are off to the army with a drill sergeant barking at them. Literally. She goes to get on the plane, and some guy gives her lays and says, aloha. Wait a minute. Was there a flight in there somewhere? We see flying now with a bunch of Japanese bombers unleashing their fury to the sound of Bleeding Heart, which is not on the soundtrack album, but was mixed in time for it. We see some stereotypical Japanese tourists. Yes, hippies still have their own prejudices. Pat and her guide romp around a field to the tune of Paley Gap near some cool radio telescopes. Then we get the foreshadowing part of the picture. The two go climbing up a hill and are almost blown over. Not that the wind does anything else in the film, but we know what it ends up causing. They hit the beach, a hippie finds something in the sand, and she finally gets to a hotel. All this done in 17 minutes. We then move to the Rainbow Bridge Occult Research Meditation Center. Everybody's there in the lotus position reciting something. They go into the water in their diaphanous robes and get wet. Okay. Pat shows up to the tune of Hey Baby. Audra Barkley rides in, sees her coming, and then races back to the house to let Nick, Keith, and Jared know somebody's coming. No, but never mind that. It's time for Tai Chi. Everybody's outside doing their moves. Inside, the hippies are having tea, and the writer lets them know, hey, Hartley's coming. Call Mr. Carlin. I'm sure he needs help. Then Pat walks in, and we get four images scrolled across the screen. Wait a minute. Is one of those Mehar Baba? The who aren't in this picture? Oh, never mind that. It's time to surf. The live Easy Rider is back. We get outtakes from Endless Summer or something like that. Supposedly that's how this whole film got started, to do a kind of follow-up to that picture with a more spiritual bent. But more than that, they're smuggling dope in the surfboards. Now that might have made for an interesting film, but they kind of forget about that after the scene. We definitely did need to see 2 or 3 minutes of some guy sneezing. That was vital. We go back to the surfing, this time to look over yonder. Sounds like a different mix than what's on the album, or maybe even a different take. And almost exactly 30 minutes in, Jimmy shows up in a picture on somebody's dashboard. We get a Bible verse before hippie Dan Haggerty said something about us landing here on Earth. And wait, has he seen Women of the Prehistoric Planet? That's the exact plot of that picture. A bunch of naked hippies swimming is augmented by a black and white comedy routine complete with Tarzan yell. Shameless self-promotion here. An episode of Tarzan at the Movies is up over at the Valleys of Numenor podcast. We go from 1918 to 1942. Then back to surfing in Room Full of Mirrors. Now, I thought this may have actually been the Mitch mix of the song, but as I was listening to it now, it might be Buddy, you know. The sound quality of the cheap old VHS tapes wasn't exactly optimal for this. Hippie Grizzly Adams is trying to get all spacey with some girl. I guess this counts as the romance in the picture. Now, somehow these guys got a leftover prop barge from Cleopatra or Ben-Hur or some Hercules picture, you know, as they're trying to get up to ramming speed as they're doing the Volga River Boatman song. You know. Just what a bunch of drunk stone people need, a rocking boat. Ooh. And now here comes Jimmy. I don't think he's on the boat because there's a brick wall right behind trucks. So not exactly conducive to floating. Now, I guess this is what counts as a script meeting. We have Chuck and Pat and Jimmy discussing the need for a plot about past lives and something like that. Nah, they're just stoned. Jimmy sounds like he's having fun, though, considering he really didn't want to be there in the first place. Oh, and he grew his mustache back compared to Berkeley. Jimmy and Pat's astrological signs are aligned, which is a good sign for things to come. So they got that going for them, which is nice. So it's time for the concert. We see the people lining up under their zodiac signs with the Gemini twins on stage. And of course, with a name like Gemini Twins, there are three of them.
Hippies.
Song's kind of nice, though. Then Chuck comes out and explains the whole purpose of the big shebang of the Rainbow Bridge. I have no idea what any of what he said means, but it's there. Boy, it's windy up there. See? That scene from earlier in the picture pays off. Then to a collective, Jimmy, Billy, and Mitch come on stage. Jimmy's got this really cool outfit on. I think they said it was a Hopi Indian, like, medicine man shirt or something like that. Looks neat. When the concert starts, they cut right to the main part of Hey Baby, because as we later found out, they didn't film the opening part or lost it or something like that. Nice opening shot, though, of Jimmy playing against a gray sky. And oops, Mitch kind of missed the cymbal hit there. Now, remember, he was playing along in the studio to a projection of the film, since the drums didn't get recorded very well, or so they thought. After a long two-shot of Jimmy and Mitch, the editor figured, I better get Billy in here, so we cut over to him. Then a shot of Mitch going completely wild on the drums, which doesn't match what's going on the soundtrack at all. There's one shot of Jimmy going up the neck while he's playing, while the soundtrack has him going down the neck, and, you know, whatever works. We get a nice shot of some girl's hair as Jimmy's trying to sing, but he's still soloing. Then we go into In From the Storm making its debut. It was only like 6 weeks old at that point. So the camera that had the two shot before shows he could get all three of the guys in one shot. So I'm going to just need to pull back. Unfortunately, we get an edit to the end of the song at that point. Then Jimmy dedicates Foxy Lady to Pat and goes into, as I've said often, my absolute favorite live version of the song. And they wisely do the whole thing, yeah, almost, but they cut the last chorus, well, close enough. The hippies liked it. Jimmy does his usual intro to Him Right Trainer Coming, calling it Get My Heart Back Together, and just less coherently befitting the situation. We get two verses and a chorus, and then he moves into the solo. It then cuts into Voodoo Child, and very well, I might add, is a really good version. It's almost like Woodstock. There's a lot of close-ups in the song. I think we even see the cameraman running out of the way at one point. There's a funny shot as Jimmy is soloing. He goes to his knees and bends backwards. He turns into a baby. Hey, that's me. Oh. Then back to the solo, and another pretty good edit into the end of Purple Haze. He does a cool thing during the outro where he plays the guitar neck from like the top instead of underneath. Then we end with the teeth playing and he does so Star Spangled Banner for a couple seconds. Then they try to go back to Him Right Trainer Coming into the quiet section. That doesn't quite work. They fade back to the script meeting and Jimmy talks about hanging with Cleopatra. I mean, you guys got a boat. They get this beautiful shot of Jimmy sitting on a rocks during the sunset. I think they put it on either the back cover or on the inside of the album. It's a very nice shot. Then he starts talking about choking on grapes and stealing Cleo from Mark Anthony, I think. We then see a little of the second set where Jimmy has the flying V and is doing an intro to Hey Baby that we didn't get in the other set because they missed it. Plus, we get interpretive dance on the side of the stage too. But then as he heads towards the song, they fade it out. But it's okay. We know he doesn't do the full song anyway. That's it for Jimmy. A bunch of people go prancing around a local volcano to the sound of a flute song. It almost looks like the Spanish desert from For a Few Dollars More on The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. Thing is, if I was at a drive-in, I'd be leaving already. Time to go to bed. But there's still more at a meeting house where they hear more mystical stuff about a space goddess or something like that. From a new age Dr. Joyce Brothers. They leave to the tune of the studio Hey Baby, which actually does work in context with their previous conversation. Then the volcano explodes and wipes everybody out. Wait, what? The casting credits do something different. They actually go down into the lava. Then we get the same that started the picture to end it. It's rated R for the naked hippies, I guess. I mean, I didn't hear any F words or anything like that. It's easy to make fun of a movie like this, but this was a whole school of filmmaking back then. Chuck was friends with Andy Warhol, and this was their thing. But I do have to point out, after watching the back-to-back, you actually get more sustained Jimmy here than in Jimmy Plays Berkeley. Despite the technical difficulties, it was a good performance, and kudos to the camera guys. They were able to get some pretty nice shots. It does look like they used two different exposures in the different cameras, though. One looks totally different than the other. It's like you see one, it's all nice and clear. The other one's kind of grainy. And that one sequence of Him Right Trainer Coming into Voodoo Child into Purple Haze is very well done. It's almost as if he performed it that way until they tried to jam the second part of Him Right Trainer Coming back onto the end. That just didn't work. Needless to say, Rainbow Bridge was not successful at the box office, so Mike Jeffries' two big film projects had flamed out. So what does he do? Right, start working on a third. We've gone over a film about Jimi Hendrix pretty well back in episode 3, so we'll do a quick once over, just maybe a little bit more in-depth about what we're actually seeing. This was a documentary done about Jimmy by Joe Boyd, John Head, and Gary Weiss, who later go on to the short film Saturday Night Live in the 70s. It combined interviews and performance footage from Monterey, Woodstock, Berkeley, and Isle of Wight. The people interviewed were, among others, Pete Townshend, Eric Clapton, Al Hendrix, Thane Pridgen, the Aline Brothers, back when they were the Allen Brothers, Eric Barrett, Paul Caruso, Linda Keith, Mick Jagger, Little Richard, Lou Reed, Pat Hartley, who's almost a star of the film, Alan Douglas, and bandmates Mitch Mitchell, Billy Cox, Duma Salton, and Buddy Miles. Noel Redding was in a legal dispute with the record company and declined to participate. I don't know why Chaz didn't show up. He gets a thank you at the end. My mom liked Jimmy's old army commander and the way he pronounced the guitar. There's also an out-of-nowhere inclusion of feminist author Germaine Greer. As for what appears in the film, the credits roll over Rock Me Baby from Monterey making a debut here. Wild Thing is cross-faded here and there with interviews, then into the Dick Cavett appearance. We do also get some alternate shots here and there, so they must have had access to the footage. We get an edited section of the Isle of Wight machine gun, no lyrics, just playing, but the first time anything for Jimmy's performance there was seen. Johnny B. Goode fades in just like it did in Jimmy Plays Berkeley, definitely implying they didn't get the opening on film. Hey Joe from Monterey makes his debut here as well. Purple Haze is done in a combo. The first part is from the Marquee Club appearance on B Club from 1967. Then in the middle, it switches to Berkeley just in time for Jimmy's lyric mistake. Then we get the final Monterey debut of Like a Rolling Stone. Star Spangled Banner from Woodstock is next, and it's very interestingly done. Since the film came out from Warner Brothers and Reprise was part of that conglomeration, they had access to all the footage shot for the film. So they decided to not only use an alternate edit of the performance, but mostly an alternate angle as well. The entire song is presented almost completely from a camera shooting Jimmy from below the stage to his right, so you can see everything he's doing the entire time. Next, we get some of the black and white videotape footage of the band of gypsies doing Machine Gun. Again, no lyrics, but it starts out with the killer solo and plays a minute or two of that. The acoustic Hear My Train of Coming footage follows, and like his earlier appearance, it cuts out towards the end. This time, they use the footage of Jimmy and Devin in the limo from Jimmy Plays Berkeley to finish up the song. The last two performances of the film are appropriately from his last big performance at Isle of Wight. Red House is presented almost in full. It picks up right where he starts the lyrics. There's a very cool shot from the stage, but it was kind of like Sly Stone at Woodstock performing in front of 500,000 people. You couldn't see at 2 a.m. The final song is in from The Storm, starting right as Mitch ends the drum solo and Jimmy counts in. We get the whole song right down to Jimmy dropping the guitar at the end, which in this case is also the end of the film. So the movie premiered new songs from Isle of Wight and Monterey, while there's nothing new from Berkeley. I do wonder if the sections of the song from Monterey were edited together by Pennebaker, because as we'll see later, it basically showed up in this form in a future project. Again, it wasn't a big hit at the box office, and the soundtrack didn't do too well either, causing Warners to review their strategy going forward, leading to Alan Douglas's assuming leadership of the catalog for the next 20 years. The film did get a bit of a revival once cable and VHS came around in the 80s. It would be on shows like Night Flight on USA Network and was readily available on videotape at an affordable price. So it was the most accessible way to see Jimmy live in a number of different performances. Later on, we'd get full concerts of Monterey and Isle of Wight, at least what was shot, but we'll talk about those as they premiered in the 80s and 90s. Next time we move into the age of home video, where it was now desirable and affordable to put things out that couldn't have been done earlier, but certain parts of the world were luckier than others and got more than we did here in the States. We'll run down what we can next time. For all our listeners here in the U.S., have a happy upcoming 4th of July. Please hit the subscribe button if you like what you're hearing. I'm John Hartart. Thanks for listening.